Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 392 for comics originally released on February 11th, 2015. Now, starting us off in DC is Green Lantern Corps number 39. I've been reading this, obviously, the whole New 52, and I've been reading the Green Lantern franchise for long time. How about you? Have you been keeping up with this? Have you dropped on and off?
Yeah, I haven't read this for a long time, a couple years.
Okay, all right. Basic premise, there's more than one Green Lantern. There's a whole core of them. Really, if at this point you don't know what it is, there's not much I can do to educate you on this. This is just the lesser-known Green Lanterns to a degree. The writer is Van Jensen, which is a name that doesn't really ring any bells for me. I believe he's done Pinocchio, Vampire Slayer, and not much more than this. And I think he's been on Flash since issue 30. And I think he got on board this issue 21, maybe. And then the artist is Bernard Chang, who he's been around the industry for a long time. I believe he was doing some stuff back at Valiant, not the current one, but the previous Valiant, even. Unless I'm confusing him with somebody else, for some reason I'm thinking he was the one who did the second life of Dr. Mirage back in the day. Good artist and such. It wasn't but a couple of years ago that the whole Green Lantern franchise, under the guidance of Geoff Johns, was really just at the top of its game, doing some great stuff. Here we are, we've gotten word that going into Convergence, they're ending this title and, I guess, Green Lantern New Guardians. They're going to retool some stuff or just change up the titles and whatnot. And when you've got Geoff Johns, you know, when he's at the top of his game, and I would be hard-pressed to name anything other than the Green Lantern titles defining the top of his game, because I think he really just expanded the franchise. And then you know, he steps away, other people take on the book, or titles, plural. It's hard to not consider them kind of, you know, a lower rung of creator, just because I don't think you can get much higher at DC than, you know, chief creative officer. And Geoff Johns is a damn good writer. Hard act to follow. Having read this, I don't think it was badly written. I don't think it was a bad story, but it lacked sparkle. It lacked real oomph. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't brilliant.
Yeah, I think you're being kind. It was really boring. And maybe, you know, for you, I'm sure you know, it's part of the story that you've been reading, so it probably wasn't as bad. But if you're coming into this thing cold, there is absolutely zero here for you to get your interest piqued, to pull you into the story, to make you want to root for the characters or continue on in their journey and their adventures. Absolutely nothing here to hang your hat on. Very vanilla, boring. Unfortunate. It's really unfortunate. There was just nothing here for me.
Well, and it's funny because I think the story was effectively told. I just didn't find it all that impressive or frankly unimpressive of a story. It just kind of was there. And that's why I did a little research on Van Jensen, the writer. Is, you know, I look at the pages, there's nothing about it that's, ooh, he's got a writing crutch that just isn't working, or he's trying to be fancy and that's not pulling it off. I mean, the mechanics of the writing are solid, but there's plain vanilla, like you were saying, is a good example, a good description of this. It seems very average. It's certainly not something that's going to get somebody very excited about the property, the characters, or anything of the sort. And it ends on what I think was meant to be, or not meant to be, I'm certain it was meant to be a reveal. And I think I even know what it was, you know, referencing, but it fell flat for me. And if it's referencing what I think it was, the reason it fell flat was because my memory doesn't extend that well that far back. And if it's hearkening back to what I think it was, I mean, that's stuff that was just ages gone by that a lot of readers may have heard about but may not have read. And I could be wrong as to what it's referencing, in which case it totally fell flat because it missed the mark for me. No, I had to read into the story what was going on there versus reading out of the story what was there. But I think Bernard Chang did a fine job with the art. And if you were to go through it on a page by page at a technical level, I don't think there are any fundamental flaws in the craftsmanship, but these are just, particularly in the writing, it's a journeyman level of writing. And I think it's simply that Van Jensen hasn't done that much work. You know, he's been on this book a year and a half, Flash for about 9 months, I think. And the only other thing I found in Comic Book DB was the Pinocchio Vampire Slayer, Pinocchio Vampire Slayer in the Great Puppet Theater, and Pinocchio Vampire Slayer of Wood and Blood, which is a two-parter. Original graphic novels, moderately humorous, you know, premise or whatever there, I guess. I just don't know that this guy has done a whole lot. And I hope doing more gets him more polished, gets him better at his craft.
Would you say DC has a house style in their some of their storytelling tropes, storytelling beats, maybe, that kind of limit a lot of their titles, their second, third tier titles? Yeah, they just seem to be going through the motions in a lot of these? Or is it, am I being overly harsh?
I don't think you're being overly harsh. I would almost phrase it as a house lack of style. And I think that is being harsh. There are a lot of the books out there that are just, they feel a little bland. It almost feels like some of the creators don't have their heart in it. And I wonder if that's editorial on high saying, these are the books we want done. Go find somebody to go do them, you know. And the editor they have here, let's see, we've got an associate editor, Darren Shan, who I don't recognize the name of. Group editor, Matt Idelson. That name rings a bell, although I would be hard-pressed to name what else he's done editing-wise. But it's not like we've got heavy hitters on the editorial side to give the creative team great guidance. And if it's being, you know, and it may not be. It may be that this is the exact story that Van Jensen is very passionate about telling. I don't know. If it is, it's not coming across on the page.
Well, to go back, I mean, technically, you're correct. It artistically, it's fine, and it seems to have a story in there. But the most exciting thing about this book was the preview of Suiciders in the back, the glimpse at the new Suicide Squad lineup, and in the Channel 52, and that Hot Topic is carrying Harley Quinn clothing.
So you're saying the entire 20 or so page story was eclipsed by promotion for the Vertigo stuff that we've seen in pretty much every other book for the last couple of weeks, the Channel 52 feature, and the DC All Access page.
Yes.
Wow. Now, granted, it was, as far as DC All Access pages go, not bad. As far as Channel 52 installments, again, probably better than most. I'd seen the Suiciders enough that it's like, you know, this again. But I also think that the main story itself had so little. And again, it's not that it's bad. It's that it's boring.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want people to think, oh, geez. I mean, again, the art's fine. The story is effectively told. It's just not an exciting story. This, to me, is systemic at DC these days. Yeah, I think it's a problem across the board.
And I was waffling between the C- and the D, and I think I have to go C- because, like you said, technically it's not bad. It's not executed poorly. It's just so boring. It's clearly below average.
Yeah. For me, I went with the C. It's if you go in liking the characters, I think you're going to come out still liking them. But it really just it didn't move the needle in either direction. It shows that the writing is the weak spot. I don't think the art really had any great place to shine, but I think Chang did a fine job with it. Again, nothing to say, wow, you should get the book because of the art either. But this is a writer that just needs more time, needs some guidance, needs a little something. Not a writer I'm going to stay away from. Certainly not somebody I think is doing a bad job. But too many books at DC are just in that kind of there and, frankly, a little boring state. And it's got no continuity other than a couple of years to really rest on in some cases. So that's not helping DC. They need to step up their game. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. And I'm very optimistic about Convergence and those books that are coming out of Convergence. And there hopefully will be some new blood, some revitalization, some excitement pumped into some of these titles and, you know, hook me again.
Devil's advocate here for a moment. Suppose there is all of that. Some excitement, some new ideas, it's a step up. Okay, it's a bold new direction, like the new 52 was a few years ago.
Is it sustainable, all right?
Like 1 year later was a few years prior to that. I mean, they're getting at the point where they're just constantly, oh, we're going to not restart, relaunch, but but do another push, get a little traction, and then just it dispels. It doesn't stick together, you know?
So then that goes to the talent pool, does it not? That does DC just not have the talent, the second level talent to carry enough books? Does Marvel have more? Because I think they have a larger percentage of quality books than DC right now.
I would agree with that.
And it has to go back to the talent pool.
I'm not sure
on the writing side.
I'm not sure that it does, because I think you could almost and Sabermetrics is what's coming to mind here with the whole Moneyball mindset. If you've got people that have certain skills but are undervalued in the position they're at, and you move them to a better position, you can have potentially lower tier athletes making for a higher tier team just by how you use them. And certainly, don't get me wrong, I think Marvel has some amazing creators and probably overall a stronger batch of creators than DC. But I think more importantly, Marvel is able to leverage their creators a heck of a lot better than DC is. That to me is the difference. It's not just who you've got, but how you use them. But, you know, they need both. They need to use better creators. They need to make use of creators better and have some better creators. I don't think they've scraped the bottom of the barrel by any stretch on the creative talent that's out there. I think there's a lot of creative people there. I think they've got a lot of really good people on staff. But I look at so many of their titles, and it's kind of ho-hum.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So on that resoundingly positive note, shall we move over to Marvel?
Yeah.
We've got Darth Vader number one. Now, speaking of talent, we've got Kieran Gillen as the writer. We've got Salvador LaRocca on art. I think this is a very solid creative team. Hard to go wrong with that. And they open with a kind of a standard Star Wars movie style opening. Long time ago in a galaxy far away, you get the big splash of the Star Wars, Darth Vader, and then the scrolling text, and then boom, we're in the story. So they did that on Star Wars. I wouldn't be surprised if they do it on Princess Leia. Is it formulaic? Maybe. Does it work? Yeah. Okay, I'm good with that. But like Star Wars, I think the fact they put a really solid creative team on this really worked well. There were a couple of pages that had no dialogue and needed no dialogue, and I didn't do a page count on this, but it seemed a lot longer than usual.
Yeah, in the 30s, right?
Something like that. So page issue and a half, essentially, of content. And there was an aspect where there was a little bit of a leisurely pace, but I never felt it was decompressed or going too slow. It just gave us time to kind of soak in the moments, and I liked that.
Oh, yeah. It really worked for me. And, you know, it had the advantage. It's a number one issue. It's a property that I have affection for. And I'm coming off of two really strong issues of its sister title. And I was really pleasantly surprised to see this. For some reason, I thought this might be its own separate continuity almost, that it might be Darth Vader's tales that weren't connected to the Star Wars title, but it was really cool to see that it was rooted in that plot line from the first couple of issues. That was really cool the way that it transitioned really seamlessly and felt, you know, just like a nice companion piece to that book, which I enjoyed. So had a lot of stuff going for it going into this, and it delivered. I thought it was as good as the Jason Aaron book that we reviewed. I think it was really strong, and another good solid offering in this part of the universe.
I would agree with that entirely. I mean, they came out of the gate with a solid Star Wars number one, followed it up with a very good second issue, and then, like you said, this just seems to expand very favorably on what they're doing there. And, I mean, Dark Horse did a great job with Star Wars over the years, and Marvel is, you know, taking over the franchise and producing quality comics that are easily on par with what Dark Horse had done. So, you know, anyone who's upset that it left Dark Horse, and I think there's reason to be, I think, again, Dark Horse had the tenure and would have been nice if they could have kept it, but it's not like Marvel is squandering this or cashing in needlessly or using, you know, lesser talent or anything of the sort. They're giving this their A game, and I really respect that, and I'm really enjoying it. This is a fun read.
Yeah, now, Salvador LaRocca, he has a bit of a problem here, because Darth Vader can't really emote his features. So, you know, it seems like that would be a real problem to get any kind of emotion out of that character because his face can't change.
Yeah.
So, and it was really cool the way that they laid out the panels back and forth, and they let Jabba the Hutt do a lot of the emoting from the facial features because of that limitation with Darth Vader's helmet and things. But I still thought it worked really well, even with that limitation. I mean, you got more Darth Vader here than we probably got out of the movies, you know, a lot of screen time. And well, it was awesome.
It read like a movie that was starring Darth Vader. He was the lead character. No two ways about it. I mean, everything revolves around him here. And you're right with the mask, the helmet, whatever. Dramatically, there's really not much you can do with that. But it never got in the way of the story. It never felt like he was just almost a statue being positioned in the scenes or something. He was a character. He had emotion. He had gravitas or whatever. And again, that's, like you said, very challenging, I think, job for an artist.
It's really cool to see. Obviously, the creators love the material they're working with. It feels incredibly authentic. It feels incredibly rooted in the cinematic universe that I love. And I mean, it's really a great companion to that. And what I think this is better than the Star Wars title is in the character faces, the ones that are rooted in faces that we recognize from the actors from the movies. I think LaRocca does a much better job than Cassaday did in capturing it and consistently rendering it over and over again throughout. It didn't change a lot. Now, he had less characters to work with, but I thought the ones that he did were spot on and were well done throughout.
I would agree with that. Again, it was easy to get immersed back into the film reality.
It really was, yeah.
And there are a couple of places where one of the things they do with Darth Vader is almost, I don't say play with, but leverage the lighting of the helmet. There's the scene where he's talking with the Emperor and such. And, you know, just seeing, it's at the center there with the staple at the Imperial Palace. Got one panel where there's a lot of reflection on the helmet. We go a little further. Now it's the light has shifted a little or something. And it makes what would have been essentially almost the same panel, the same scene, feel like, okay, time has elapsed, things have moved. It's a subtle thing, but it makes it more like watching a movie than reading a comic. The only place here where, I mean, yes, it's clear these guys love Star Wars. The only place where I felt it's like, you know, is that really the right thing to have done for this character based on what we've seen in the movies was at the end. There was an aspect there with Darth Vader and what's going on that almost made him seem a little petty. And it's like, you know, I thought he had dealt with a certain thing or a certain moment or whatever, and that was in his past. Yet what we get here doesn't seem to reflect that. But it was also a really cool reveal and a very, you know, Darth Vader kind of a moment, you know, that you know, helps establish his character for whoever happened to have been living under a rock and not know the character. Because I can't imagine how anyone could not know who Darth Vader is. I suppose it's possible.
I thought that worked in a way to punctuate this book by saying, oh, and don't forget, he's a bad guy. You know, just in case you started to feel for him a little too much, don't forget, he's a bad guy. And lest you forget, here's a reason to remember.
It just seemed a little similar to what we had seen in one of the book one, two, or three movies. I guess two or three or whatever. It just seemed a little not derivative, not reminiscent, but almost repetitive. But you're right. It narratively, it served the purpose, even if it's like, would that really have happened or not? Who cares? It was a fun scene. It revealed what it needed to, and yes, it reminds you, he's Darth Vader.
Yeah.
He is the bad guy, even if he's the quote-unquote hero of the book.
Did you have the action figures as a kid?
I still have a bunch.
Now, was there ever a black-haired Wookiee bounty hunter?
Not that I recall, but I didn't have enough to know for sure.
I don't remember that character ever existing before. That was cool, though. Very cool.
Well, the Wookiee that shows up with, I guess it's Boba Fett there.
Yeah.
It's like, I have no idea who that is. But it also kind of harkens, again, the Han Solo-Chewie relationship.
Very much so, yeah.
So it fits.
It does. Yeah, this was a great debut, perfect companion piece to, really, it gets me excited for the Princess Leia book a lot more than I was, just because this was so strong. I love this book. I give it an A.
Yeah, same here. Solid A. I think if I had felt that the end scene kind of jived a little bit better with what I think of some of the previous movies and stuff, it could have easily gotten that A+. This was solid stuff. One thing I do want to mention, we rarely, if ever, mention the ads in the books, but this was one where I actually saw one. It's like, hang on, I got to go check this website out. There's apparently, not apparently, there's definitely an ad here from Brian's Toys. Selling toys has never been easier. They have like an Apple and Android apps where I guess you can scan your toys and sell them to this place. And, you know, you were mentioning, did I have any of the action figures? Yeah, I've got a bunch. And they're just sitting in a box, not doing me any good. So, interesting ad. I may look into that further.
It's brilliant because how many lapsed comic readers are coming back for this book anyway, and the Star Wars book before, and, you know, are of that generation and have the Star Wars toys. I mean, what a brilliant ad. Good call.
It's a win-win for everybody. It's a great ad to put into that particular book. They stand a good chance of getting, you know, toys that they can then sell to other people. So it's good for the people selling the toys, the store who's able to flip them to other people, and the people who buy them from the store. I mean, this is, that's awesome. That is a well-placed ad. I don't know how it came to be or who to thank for that, but whether I take advantage of it and sell off some of my toys or not, I like seeing that sort of an appropriate of an ad in a comic. Shall we move on to our other book of the week?
Yeah.
This is Divinity Number 1 from Valiant. The premise of the series is, this is Divinity Number 1 from Valiant. This is one of those, I'm not sure I could tell you what the premise of this is just yet. We were going to read an IDW book and review it, but IDW's having some issues with the stuff going on at the West Coast port. So items in transit are in transit. So it's like, okay, we got to fill something in. This was a good pick. I love Valiant books. I was going through this, and the phrase that popped into my mind, I think, was Hans and Franz of Saturday Night Live. You know, hear me now, listen to me later. But to paraphrase it, you know, read me now and understand me later. There were aspects of this that, on the surface, I was completely able to follow the story of Abram Adams and what was going on and stuff. It made sense. Then they introduced David Camp, another character, about halfway through. It got a little confusing. And I got a lot of what was put in front of me, but I felt like there was a lot behind that and a lot more going on that I was just missing. And I think part of it is they just haven't given it to us yet. And this is a four-issue series that I'm sure by that fourth issue, I'm either going to think, wow, this is complete junk. What was I wasting my time on? Or, oh my God, this was brilliant. I'm hoping for the, oh my God, it was brilliant. But this is a story that I think there's more going on than I think I pulled out of the issue. What were your thoughts?
About two-thirds of this book I really, really enjoyed. I like the whatever the main character's name is, the cosmonaut. I thought that was really great, and I really enjoyed his story. And then they introduced the rock climber, David, I think his name was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought, okay, these folks are going to intersect somewhere down the road. And then it started getting a little trippy, so it lost me a little bit there towards the end. But I did enjoy the main storyline, and I'm hoping we have more of that, and they can flesh out some of this other stuff down the road. I think Matt Kent is a really good writer. Trevor Hairsine, I think, is the artist. I'm not really that familiar with his work, but it was fine art. Interesting debut, very interesting issue, and something I think I'll stick around with.
Well, it's one of those things that I really enjoyed the issue. I thought it was good. There are a couple of places I'm like, well, wait, what's going on here? Again, when they bring in the other character of David Camp, when they're kind of sort of intertwining, but not quite. And I think there's a little bit of kind of an implied time travel thing going on here with the lead character that we just don't have enough context yet to make it make sense.
Since this is one of our picks, how much spoiling or speculating can we do in this?
Speculating tons. Spoiling, hey, I would be impressed.
Well, is it, are we, is there enough there for us to surmise that David is the cosmonaut's son that he left behind with the girlfriend?
That's entirely possible. I'll be honest, that hadn't even occurred to me. It fits the facts as presented, though.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I thought we should have gotten, if that is where they were headed. I thought maybe if they could have left that story beat on the page somewhere, a little more on the nose, if that's what it in fact is, I thought that would have helped. I really like the pencils that they added in the back, and some of the back matter stuff, some of the sketches of the pods and the spacecraft that we really don't get to see that much of. Well, that was kind of a really cool addition. And throwaway stuff, you know, B-side stuff, but still, it was interesting.
It was, but after that last scene where some really interesting and unusual things happen, I was just sort of perplexed enough and thinking, you know, there's a level of this, there's something I'm just not getting quite yet. And that as much as I like the back matter, I was literally coming out of the story almost in a little bit of a stunned state. This is really good. I like it. I'm not sure I get it. And that's a very different feeling than I liked it. I know I don't get it, and therefore I don't think it's good. You know, and it's a fine line between those. You know, if this had been a little bit more obtuse or something, I might have come out of it thinking, well, they haven't really told me much. They just showed me some stuff. Who cares? But I want more of this story. And, you know, we're a quarter of the way through. I don't know if the page count's consistent across the four issues. Probably will be, but whatever. I would have hoped at this point to have a little bit of a better idea of the bigger picture story. But it was, like I said, enjoyable enough at a surface level and in the moment that I'll certainly ride it out for the full four issues.
Yeah, this doesn't feel like it's part of the Valiant universe at all. Is it supposed to be connected in some way?
As far as I know, it is part of the Valiant universe, but there is absolutely nothing in here whatsoever to really justify or to say either way.
Yeah.
It's completely standalone.
So that's good and bad. If you have tried Valiant and don't like it, don't like the universe, there's nothing to keep you from checking this out because you don't really see any of the other characters or anything from the universe. And then also, if you are a Valiant reader, then you should definitely check this out because it down the road might tie in somehow to the universe that you're reading. And yeah, I think it was good. And there was some puzzling things at the end that hopefully doesn't overwhelm some of the future issues. But I think there was enough good stuff here that I gave it a B.
For me, it came down to a B minus just because I came out of it not entirely sure everything about what was going on.
Oh, yeah.
And again, there's nothing wrong with that. But I would have liked to have come out of it not thinking, you know, that I'd kind of clearly missed something. But again, it was in a way that if I missed it, I want to get it versus I missed it and I just don't care. So there's that.
Right. Right. And it was interesting. And, you know, it had the advantage over the DC title of being a number one issue as well. But I just keep going back to you know, these last two were very interesting books, very interesting stories. I really liked what I was reading. I was intrigued. I was pulled in.
Mm-hmm.
That DC book, it just didn't do anything for me.
I would say the Darth Vader one was the most immersive, but it also had a rich film history to draw on for that.
Yeah.
Divinity started with nothing and was pretty engrossing and pulled me into the story, even if I was a little bewildered at parts of it. But, you know, I know what's going on with the Green Lantern Corps and have for frankly, decades. I just didn't get pulled into the story. I just didn't connect with it.
Yeah.
So I totally see what you're saying there. And there have been a couple of times you've mentioned the advantage of a first issue. And I think that's a really interesting point because in a first issue, whether you're starting with Darth Vader with a you know, rich history or Divinity with a blank slate, you've got the ability and almost the responsibility as a storyteller to establish the scene, the tone, the style, the characters. You've got to cover a lot of ground. It's expected, it's desired, and therefore it makes a first issue really easy to seem like it's got a rich immersive, deep level of story, whereas second and third issues and subsequent issues...
39. Issue 39, yeah. That's going to be tough.
Yeah, you've got the momentum behind you, so you don't really have the time or the ability to keep building it up that way. Because if you did, by the time you hit issue 39, it would be impossible to keep track of. So I definitely think first issues have an advantage in that respect.
Which is why we review a lot of first issues.
Well, and I also think a lot of people are trying to figure out what's worth their time and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get somebody on board, no matter how great that Green Lantern Corps issue could have been, even if it had been a perfect one, a lot of people, and rightfully so, would say, oh, it's issue 39. Geez, you know, I don't know. You know, if it was just starting, I'd get in. And you know, I get it. It makes sense. And it wasn't that brilliant. You made the right choice to not stay with it. Or to, you know what I mean, to not get on board with the 39th issue of a title that's ending within a few issues.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was worth checking out.
Sure.
What else did you read this week?
Oh, over at Boom, they finished up the Wild's End. Number 6 came out, and Dan Abnett was doing the writing on there, and it was a really fun sci-fi anthropomorphic animal story that is going to be a great trade. I wholeheartedly recommend that to folks, that when that comes out, that'll be a great story to read in trade, and really pretty to look at, and a great story, and a lot of fun in there. Definitely check that out. Over at Dark Horse, the second issue of Conan Red Sonja that we reviewed a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew you said that there really wasn't anything there that would keep you, make you want to add this title. And, you know, I said I'd check out that second issue to see if you had missed out, but I think you were right on. It's about the same level as that first issue was.
Well,
so if you like that, you know, keep reading it. But they're not that engrossing.
I didn't have any problem with the quality of it. I just don't have any attachment to either character, and therefore there was nothing pulling me in, keeping me in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas there are others, it's like, you know, I like the character just fine, but I'm not loving the story or whatever. But no, it's good to know on that one.
I thought the second issue of Secret Six was really good. It felt delayed. I'm not sure when it was supposed to come out, but it feels like it's been a lot longer than a month since that first issue. And it lost a little momentum for me because of that. But I thought it was a pretty good second issue. And I have high hopes for that, for this series.
Yeah, I'm curious about that one. And it definitely has been delayed, because that one came out, the first issue, we reviewed that for the shipping week of December 3rd. And
yeah,
here we are talking about the shipping week of February 18th. That's the 11th. I'm sorry.
The 11th, yeah.
Still
over two months.
Over 2 months. That's not good.
And I don't believe it was pitched as a bi-monthly.
I certainly don't recall it as such. But I might not have been paying too much attention to the solicit either. One of the ones I read this week that I really enjoyed was Hulk number 11, I think it was.
Okay.
And they've got the whole Doc Green thing going on, where he's going and getting rid of the other gamma-powered people, you know, trying to be socially responsible for the gamma-powered, you know, mischief going on in the Marvel Universe or whatnot. And as fun as that part is, as interesting as that story is, the subplot is really what kind of took off in this issue, with one of the things that Doc Green has apparently set up and is just kind of going a little further afield than I think the character had expected or envisioned, and seems like it could set up some very, very explosive dynamics going down the line. And they had teased some of this, they had built some of this up, but it just took a turn that it's like, wow, this is getting really interesting. I could see a lot of story potential here.
Who's the writer on this?
That's an excellent question. Hang on, let me...
It was Mark Waid, but it's not Mark Waid anymore, is it?
No, it is not. It is Dugan.
The
Howling Commando.
The Deadpool guy.
Yes, it is. Let me actually open the thing up, get the full name of the creator. Gregarious Jerry Dugan. Yeah. Gotcha. And Mark Bagley on pencils.
Oh, okay.
Hard to go wrong with that. But some of the stuff they do, just, again, the way the issue ended, it's like, wow, that could be a lot of fun. So I always like it when that happens.
What do you think of Spider-Verse conclusion somewhat?
I think I should have read Amazing Spider-Man before I read Spider-Woman. Spider-Woman presented that as, yep, it's all done, and then I watched it all get finished. The ending fell a little flat for me.
Yeah.
It seemed to be building and building and building and just kind
of
end.
Yeah, it had all the makings early on of being a really great event. regional outcropping, whatever you like to call it. But it just went on a little too long and didn't hit all the right notes at the end enough to, yeah, just fell a little flat. I enjoyed it, and it was really fun to see all the different spider variations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the Spider-Verse went on just a tad too long. And there'll be an epilogue issue, I think, this week. So I'll be anxious to put a pin in that.
They just didn't hit the ending right.
Yeah. And it happens so often in Marvel events. I mean, almost all of them are like that. They start strong and then don't finish well.
It does. It happens a lot. It's hard to pull off a really satisfying ending. And I think if they had done that, I'd have been much, much happier and forgiven some of the standalone one-shot-ish sort of things that just, random spider character du jour. But it was a swing and a miss as far as the ending of the story went.
Yeah.
And it seems like they're going to, again, have the epilogue, have a couple other things coming out later. Spider-Verse is not over and done by any stretch. Aspects of it will, be it the Spider-Gwen series, Silk getting her own series, or I think there's even something they've solicited that'll have a handful of the different Spider-Men teaming up in a miniseries or something down the line.
The Steampunk Spider-Girl was pretty cool. I liked her a lot. There's plenty of them that they could capitalize on that I think have some more life beyond the Spider-Verse.
Totally. And it would be kind of fun if they get kind of this group of spider characters, the multi-universal version, along with, the Captain Britons of the multiverse, and maybe get a few other, and I'm not sure who would be fun characters to do that with, but again, take somebody that you just wouldn't expect, and it's like, okay, here's how they look in every other universe, and mix and match and have kind of a multiversal Avengers kind of a deal going, but... I was hoping for a little more out of the ending than we got. And the fact that I read stuff in the wrong order undercut the Amazing Spider-Man issue it's a done deal. It's all wrapped up, as far as I was concerned, before I'd even read it, thanks to Spider-Woman, which was an all right issue.
Really interesting book from, saying interesting way too often today, from Image.
Do it all the time. Get used to it.
It's called The Empty Number One, and it's an Image book that is created, written, illustrated, lettered, and colored by Jimmy Robinson. He does a lot of things on this book. Art is really kind of the weak link here. Some of the limbs on his characters are just strangely out of whack, but it's still kind of an amazing accomplishment, I think, to, this is all him. This is he put everything into this book.
He did.
Did it all. And it was really kind of cool the way it came off. Enough that I want to keep reading it, even though it's strange to look at.
He did Five Weapons. He also, I think, did Bomb Queen, and I'm trying to remember what he did before that. He's done quite a few things, and you're right, he does everything. And it gives his work a clear narrative vision, even if it may seem a little wonky either creatively with the direction he takes or some of the artistic choices. But I love the fact that you've got, some creators that, they know what they want, they're going to do it all, and hopefully they're very satisfied with the output.
Yeah, if I had any talent, this is the type of creator I would be. I would want to do it all. Just so that I wouldn't have to deal with other people's interpretation of my vision or whatever. If I had the chops, this is the way I would want to do it. So I respect that.
If I had the chops, I think it's the way I would have to do it. Whether I could get other people to work with me or not, I think once they started, I would be demanding enough they'd get tired of it.
Don't I know it?
Oh, well, it's one of those things. If you've got a creative vision, you know what you want, and even if you can't articulate it, you know what you don't want.
Yeah.
And, I mean, how many times have we heard, almost any major writer say that once they got back a script, or their script back in art form, and it's like, had nothing to do with the story they were telling. It's like,
yeah, and you hear how the relationship between Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo started out on Batman, and they're doing some amazing stuff together now, but, Scott Snyder was a full script guy that would write 50 pages for a comic, and Capullo was a Marvel Method guy who wanted an outline.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they butted heads at the beginning, and you know, the stuff that was still brilliant, the stuff that they were creating together, really cool.
The thing is, full script Marvel Method, neither is inherently superior to the other. It just comes down to whose vision, how much of a collaborative vision, and who's working with who. You know, there are times both formats, each format makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, if I had the chops, I would do as much of it myself as I could.
Yeah, I think you should check out The Empty just because it's kind of a cool accomplishment. And it's an odd book, I'll give you that, but it's kind of neat in its creativity.
Well,
I like it.
The previous stuff I've read by Jimmy Robinson definitely had a spark of creative uniqueness to it in terms of, you know, again, five weapons, clever idea, and not, wow, it's so clever, but there's no style and substance. He's able to execute on his ideas well.
Yeah.
And again, Bomb Queen was a lot of fun, too.
Boy, Walking Dead 137 was weird. It was, I don't know, I felt kind of icky after I finished reading that issue. The way that they drew the prisoner, the girl,
mm-hmm.
and then the way she acted, and I didn't know how to feel about that as I finished it. It was
I finished it, slightly nauseated was how I felt.
Yeah.
But
I thought, oh my goodness, this is not this. Of course, I knew coming, you know, you knew as soon as they introduced this girl that she was going to be more than she seems. But they just drew her so innocent and naive. And
few characters in The Walking Dead are less than what they appear.
Yeah. But it's just a, you know, it was 20 pages of story, but a lot happened, not a lot happened at the same time, but it was still, such a great, great experience.
It's an issue in which it seems like very little happens, but there are a couple of key moments that are slowly built to play out and move on that the ramifications of which could be huge.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I really like about, write and sometimes hate, I like and sometimes hate about Kirkman. He really knows how to toy with the readers.
Yeah.
And this was, I think, one of those cases in a couple of different ways. You know, I'm glad to see him back on what I consider to be his A game. I know there are other people who think he never left that on Walking Dead, but for me, he did for a little bit. He seems really energetic from a creative standpoint right now with The Walking Dead, plus all of his other work for the most part, which I think is awesome. When he's firing on all cylinders, Kirkman is just a terrific, if somewhat disturbed in a few ways, terrific writer.
Yeah, very disturbed for this issue in particular. I thought it was. It wouldn't be an episode of Weekly Comic Spotlight if we didn't talk about Astro City when it came out. And this was another good installment on characters that had not previously been explored by Kurt Busiek, and he is given these two, the royal treatment, and they're on, what, the fourth issue with these characters that he's looking at?
Third or fourth, I forget.
Third
which.
Or fourth, yeah, yeah. And it's kind of cool, though. He just pulls, you know, these were background characters from a previous run of Astro City that mm-hmm. he's just deciding to explore their backstory a little bit, and we're the beneficiaries of that.
Well, yeah, Quarrel and Cracker Jack have been around as long as I can recall with Astro City. But like you said, usually just in the background, they get mentioned, they exist. We really dive in deep on them and their relationship and what it's like to be essentially more of a street level kind of a hero in that world. And Astro City is, I think, a must read for fans of superhero stuff.
Well, I really like the way it goes, you know, shows a non-superpowered superhero versus, you know, the one that has the inherent superpowers and how different they are,
mm-hmm.
and how that division keeps them from being closer than they can be because, well, I got to train. You don't have to train every day, but I do or I die. And I thought that was pounded home brilliantly and really a great story beat.
Oh, I thought so too. It almost shows a clear class distinction within superheroics of, you know, those with the powers, those without. And it's not something that really gets played with all that much. There's been, at one point there was a Justice League 3-issue miniseries, I think it was, where superpowers just suddenly ended one day. And the Beetle and Boosters of the world were now kind of the A-list heroes. And, you know, how do the people who'd been coasting on their superpowers react to that? You know, but aside from that storyline, that's not a story beat that really most titles can play with too often. So, you know, that's part of what I love about Astro City is he's able to take things that if you just stop and think about it, the Batmans, the Captain Americas, or whoever, they're going to need to train, they're going to need to do this. That means they can't go out socializing like the Iron Mans or Supermans or Green Lanterns of the world. How does that impact the team dynamic? Yes. And we got a great story out of that this time.
More people need to be reading this book because I don't want it to ever end. And it sales are down in the teens, 15,000 or something like that. And it's not enough. More people need to be reading this so that he wants to keep writing it forever.
I think Kurt Busiek's passionate about this project that as long as he can make it viable to do, he will continue doing. But yes, more people need to read this. It's just, it's wonderfully written. And the art's great. The character designs, everything. It's iconic, classic superheroes with some style and some depth. Some people don't like it, but to me, it's a highlight anytime it comes out.
How does this run compare to some of his previous volumes of this title and the different publishers?
I would say this holds its own with the original six-issue run and the run after that. Both, I think, were through Image, the Homage line through Wildstorm. I would say, to me, the lackluster period of Astro City was the Dark Ages books 1, 2, and 3, which were four-issue miniseries. And it was not a bad story, not bad characters. It just it took too long and kept me away from the other parts of Astro City. It kind of narrowed the focus for too long. But if you're liking this run, definitely I would pick up a lot of the early material. There's none of it's bad.
The first two volumes are the place to go.
Yeah. Gotcha. That's where I would start. And again, there's not that many. It's worth going through all of them. The stuff I would put off towards the end again, and it was some of the later work, was the Dark Ages stuff. Again, not bad, but it doesn't have the more done-in-one feel that a lot of the other material has. And again, this was a four-part story we're dealing with now, which is a long one for the most part for Astro City. Most are either single-issue or two-part stories or something of that ilk.
Yeah, and my favorites, so the shorter one-and-dones, I think. But this is still strong.
Yeah.
Strong week for me. Anything else stand out for you?
Those were the main things. Another great issue of Injustice, Gods Among Us. Definitely recommend that. Anyone who has not been following New Futures End, I would recommend next time you're at the comic store, flip through issue 41. Okay. This seemed to actually be kicking some stuff into, not necessarily high gear, but into focus with some of what may be going on with Convergence, the multiverse, and some things along those lines. It was one where it's like, you know, the title's been okay, but this one really got my notice. It's like, ooh, that right there that's interesting. And the next page, wow, okay, what's going on there? So if you're into the big picture at DC, like I said, new 52 Futures End number 41, worth at the very least flipping through, if not actually picking up and checking out.
I think all the online solicitations, or almost all the online solicitations, are now up on the comic book resources pages.
I believe so. I was actually updating the forum a little earlier this evening. I don't have the DC one linked to it yet, and I thought there was one other publisher I might have missed. IDW, I don't think I've seen their solicits yet.
But on first glance, the lot of cool offerings from Boom for May. Image has just another big slew of number ones from some great superstar creators coming out, so I'm looking forward to a lot of those. I'm getting my dibs laid out for Preview Spotlight, and I suggest you guys do the same, and because there's a lot of cool stuff coming out, and it's neat that we get that little glimpse ahead of the previous catalog. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I'm hoping with Convergence, Secret Wars, all the new offerings at, you know, Image and stuff like that, that we get both more lapsed readers and stuff into comics, but also a lot more clips and stuff for the Preview Spotlight, just because there are going to be so many things competing for people's attention that, you know, if you want a book to survive, you know, give it a little nudge with our listenership and, you know, tell people why they should check it out. So the deadline for the next Preview Spotlight will be March 7th. So you got plenty of time. Again, like you said, the solicits are up. Previews will be coming out on the 25th, and DCBS orders are due on the 25th also. Tons of interesting stuff coming out. A lot of big news from most of the publishers, I think. I really think 2015 is shaping up to be just an incredibly happening kind of a year. Things changing, a lot of events, a lot of cool stories, a lot of cool properties.
Yeah.
Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
Hey, that'll do it.
Cool.
Join us next week as we discuss Batman Superman number 19 from DC, Silk number 1 from Marvel, and Secret Identities number 1 from Image Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.